The Freeman Report and James Freeman on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hello and welcome to the Freeman Report. My name is James Freeman. I'm your host for the next 2 hours right here on TNT. It is Thursday, the 2nd of May, 2024, and coming up in this hour, I'll be discussing two votes. Firstly, the vote on the Pandemic Accord Treaty at the World Health Assembly at the end of this month. And secondly, the imminent vote to decide the next leader of the UK Independence Party, aka UKIP. My guests this hour are public health expert Dr. David Bell and former MEP and UKIP leadership candidate Bill Etheridge. So, members of the World Health Organization are due to vote on amendments to the international health regulations and the accompanying Pandemic Accord Treaty at the World Health Assembly that is being held in Geneva at the end of this month. Now, the aim, according to Dr. David Bell, my first guest, is to further centralize control of public health within the WHO and change its base response to disease outbreaks, creating a heavily commoditized approach, which is contrary to the WHO's prior emphasis of building resilience to disease through nutrition, sanitation, and strengthened community-based healthcare. Now, this is very much in line with what James Roguski said when he appeared on this show on Monday, although James explained things in terms of the global trade aspect to it. Roguski explained that while many of us have been jumping up and down about certain proposals within the amendments and treaty, that isn't the thing we should be concerned about. No, what countries are doing is putting in place the legal structures that will enable all member nations to share in the spoils of future pandemics. Now, this suits larger countries with their huge pharmaceutical industries as it opens the door to a huge global market on par with the international trade in arms. And it offers smaller countries an equitable share of future capital flows generated by pandemics and health emergencies. And that's a really good point that James made, because it doesn't really matter if the WHO has legal powers over members to force them to mandate certain medicines, because countries did this regardless of international and domestic laws. The Nuremberg Code and countless established medical rules and laws on informed consent and medical harms were broken across the world in 2020 and 2021. So the WHO getting legal powers over members is not the threat that the treaty represents, because the threat of mandates and other loss of freedoms has already materialized. No, the threat comes in the form of a global trade agreement that will create huge incentives for more pandemics and public health emergencies. Because just like wars, if they're profitable, then what you get is more wars. Decisions about whether to call public health emergencies in future will therefore be about the opportunity for global trade that will be shared according to the agreement that is reached later this month. Yes, we can argue about whether there was really a global pandemic in 2020 and 2021, and there is compelling evidence and official data that strongly suggests there wasn't one. But what we can say with confidence is that COVID demonstrated the huge financial opportunities that exist if public health emergencies are called, regardless of whether they were created by media and government in lockstep or whether they're real pandemics. What we are seeing is the creation of a new medicalized global trade pact that is being driven by powerful corporations and the global elite that own and control them. Member state contributions to the WHO represent less than 20% of its budget contributions, with the rest coming from corporations, NGOs who funnel corporate money around the system, and billionaires. What they are interested in is capital flows, control, and power, not the health of populations around the world. In fact, there is a perverse incentive at the center of this move that will drive the exact opposite, because healthy populations that are not threatened by pandemics or health emergencies are not profitable. And what makes this treaty even more dangerous is the fact that there are no democratic controls or accountability within the WHO, not to the people of the world anyway. It, and it alone, can call a pandemic. And given that the business interests of member countries will be incentivized to go along with it in this agreement, that agreement presents a grave threat to the health of people around the world. Just as death and suffering is a consequence of the global arms trade, so it will be with this medicalized global trade agreement. The individual freedoms of people around the world will be disregarded, along with the health of billions of people, all in the name of capital flows and profits. That is what the vote at the World Health Organization General Assembly later this month is all about, ladies and gentlemen. Right, if you want to get in touch about anything to do with the show, email me at jamesfreeman@tntradio.live. And if you're enjoying the show, as I implore you to do every day, go to social media, whichever platform you're on, give me, James Freeman, a follow, and TNT Radio, and help us spread all of the good work that TNT is doing. My name is James Freeman. This is the Freeman Report for today's News Talk, TNT.
Be a part of the conversation.
I want representation I can trust.
Have your say.
Biden isn't doing enough.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Right, over to our UK news correspondent, Gemma Cooper, for today's breaking news. What have you got for us, Gemma?
Well, thank you very much, James. Well, in the last hour, a court in London, a magistrate's court, has heard how a 36-year-old man broke into a family home in Hainault in East London earlier in the week, threatened a father and then attacked a 14-year-old boy who later went on to be murdered. The court today has heard that 36-year-old Spanish-Brazilian national Marcos Aurelio Arduini Monzo has been charged with the murder of 14-year-old Daniel Arjurin in East London on Tuesday. The court's been hearing more detail of the crimes that he's alleged to have committed: crashing a van into the home, coming out of the van, threatening passers-by. Four people are still in hospital, two of those obviously police officers that we've been talking about over the last couple of days. This is a straight magistrate's court appearance. The court that will then be referred to Crown Court, the charge of murder. The 36-year-old is also charged with two counts of attempted murder, two counts of grievous bodily harm, a count of aggravated burglary and possession of a bladed article. And of course, tributes have been pouring in and to continue to pour in today to the 14-year-old Daniel Arjurin, who was killed on Tuesday, saying he was a much loved child and a very gentle soul. So that court case has happened now. He has appeared in front of magistrates and it will now be referred to Crown Court for a trial hearing later in the year or possibly next year, because as you know, James, we're facing a backlog of cases here in the UK. Also, scenes in South East London outside a big Best Western hotel. Police have surrounded protesters who arrived at the hotel earlier amid reports that around 200 asylum seekers were due to be moved from that hotel in Peckham, southeast London, to the controversial Bibby Stockholm barge moored over the south coast by Dorset, the Dorset coastline. Police have now said that this will not be tolerated. They've slashed the tyres, the protesters allegedly, of the coach that came to pick up the asylum seekers, thrown bikes, e-bikes, under the coach's wheels and have formed a human chain. Many of the protesters wearing masks. The Home Office in the last 15 minutes have come out to say that their behaviour is aggressive and intimidating. And the Home Office is saying that all they want to do is move the asylum seekers from a hotel, which is costing the UK taxpayers more money than it would to house them in the Bibby Stockholm barge. Some people dispute that fact, but certainly hundreds of people there and the police there as well. No arrests made yet, but that situation is ongoing. And also a big case at the High Court in London today, lodged by the Black Cabbies of London. 10,500 black cab drivers have employed lawyers to take Uber, the big corporate giant Uber, to the High Court. This is an ongoing court case that was postponed during the pandemic. The cab drivers, the black cabbies as they're known, are accusing Uber of obtaining their licenses from Transport for London under illegal grounds, taking away legitimate business from the black cabs of London. Uber deny that, say all their licenses were obtained legally. The lawsuit itself is worth 250,000 250 million. 250 million with each of the black cab drivers due to a payment of £25,000 if they are successful. But as I say, Uber denying that claim, saying that all the licenses they obtained in 2012 for their licenses to operate in London were legal.
Gemma, on that that murder of the 14-year-old boy, is this Spanish-Brazilian, is he a UK citizen, do you know?
That is I thought you might ask me that. I don't know. Spanish-Brazilian national is what we know. I don't know whether he's been granted citizenship, whether he was over here on some kind of working visa, tourist visa, UK visa. That I will look into that, and I will definitely bring you an update on that if I can in the second hour of your show, because that is a question I'm sure will be on many, many people's lips. Was this person granted citizenship, or were they here on some kind of visa arrangement prior to Brexit or post-Brexit? I don't know on that one. The court's only been hearing about the details of the alleged a crime. Obviously, he's been charged with murder. The fact that he broke into a house where a four-year-old girl was asleep before threatening the father and then killing, tragically, Daniel, 14-year-old Daniel. That's what the court heard this morning. The actual details of citizenship were gone into in specifics, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and the only reason I'm asking this is not because, it's kind of like trying to pick on people that maybe shouldn't be in the country or whatever. But, I guess my next question is, was he known to the police? Because what strikes me with this is, when people go and do something horrific like that, it's very rarely the first time, the first thing that they've done. Because that's a hell of a thing to take a sword, crash a car into someone's house and basically just go on a rampage and start killing people. That's a hell of a thing to do. People, unless they've got mental health problems and it just happens without any planning, but he clearly was in the car, he had a sword with him. So I don't think that's the case. Usually they've been involved with the police. They're known to the police for something, because there's actions that they've committed leading up to this, which has almost prepared them to be able to do that. No normal person who's never done anything like that would just go and do that, unless they were severely, had real severe mental health problems. Is there any indication whether he was known to the police?
All I know from that is that we go back to the press conference earlier in the week after the attacks had happened, which you and I discussed, which is when pressed, the chief superintendent heading the inquiry, when asked, was this person known to you, wouldn't comment. When asked, was this person arrested before previously, wouldn't comment, which is interesting, because obviously if you cast your mind back to the Valdo Calcone case, which was three stabbings in Nottingham in the Midlands in June 2023, that was a case where the suspect was known to police, had been arrested, yeah, and still had slipped through the mental health net. And that's very clear now, and had gone on to commit these crimes. And then eventually, when convicted, was sectioned under the Mental Health Act, which is different from just being sent to a normal prison. So no, not yet. We haven't heard that. And when you have a magistrate's hearing, a magistrate's hearing like we've heard this morning, it doesn't go into those specifics. That's what will come out in the Crown Court trial, unless the suspect pleads guilty, and then it will be a straight conviction. But a magistrate's court hearing is just to hear the basic facts of the case as outlined by the prosecution, to confirm your name, address, date of birth, and then it's a straight referral. So you'd never hear very many facts on an initial magistrate's hearing in the UK. They're just to confirm the basics. But these facts have come out in court. A few interesting facts from the mainstream about this man, though. Maybe they are trying to portray in a certain way, which is a very dangerous thing to do, actually, once proceedings are active court-wise. Yeah. But he described himself as a self-styled mystic, this Spanish-Brazilian, Marcus Aurelio Alredini Monzo. That's how the mainstream are portraying him. He's a mystic, he's a shaman. And whether this is an attempt to demonize people who are slightly left of center or slightly alternative, I don't know. What's that got to do with, plenty of people now identify with those kind of alternative labels like shaman, mystic. Plenty of people are into meditation and yoga. That doesn't make you a knife-wielding maniac, and the mainstream are being very disingenuous, I think, trying to link the two together. That's not evidence, I think, that will be brought out in court necessarily, but it's what the mainstream are trying to do. The facts are that he's been charged with murder. The facts are he's appeared in magistrate's court this morning, and the facts are a 14-year-old boy, Daniel Anjorin is dead. Those are the facts, yeah. Unfortunately, in the UK.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I was just asking the question, do we know the answers to this question? Obviously, we should be very careful not to speculate, given now that he's been charged. So I think I'll leave it at that. But obviously, if you do hear anything more, please let me know in the second hour, Gemma. Right. OK, to the rest of you, we're going to take a short break now. And then after that break, I'm going to be welcomed by the fabulous Dr. David Bell. He has been on the Freeman Report before. I thought he was a great guest, but he's coming back and we're going to be talking all about the WHO vote coming up in Geneva at the end of this month. So stay right where you are, right here on TNT.
The Light is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. thelightpaper.co.uk.
Our next steps to space.
This time we go back to the moon to learn to live, to work, to invent, to create.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Right, now we've talked about the WHO treaty and the amendments to the international health regulations a lot on the Freeman Report recently, and I think probably the biggest revelation that I've had about the whole treaty was a conversation that I had on this show on Monday with James Roguski, who's an expert on the WHO. I'm absolutely delighted that I've got another expert on public health, Dr. David Bell, who's with me now, because I think we're going to have a very interesting conversation about this vote, which is coming up at the end of this month. So welcome back to the Freeman Report, Dr. David Bell.
Thanks, James.
Now, David, let's start off at the beginning with this. Let's remind viewers what the advice was from the WHO across 2020 and 2021. And I guess, you know, let's look at what the impact of that advice and the policies that flowed from that has been around the world.
Essentially, the WHO and various partners who are connected with them, they advise that there is a virus which is almost certainly, you know, gain of function from a lab and a lab leak. But that aside, it was a virus that they knew very early in 2020 targeted old sick people. The average mortality is about 80 in most countries. So that they knew this. They knew that it was very rarely harmed fit adults and children. They knew this from China, where there was good early data. Despite that, they launched a completely novel way of handling such a virus, which was to essentially close down society, to use lockdowns, which were previously a prison term, to stop people working, use something called social distancing. You know, we stand 6 feet apart, which is irrelevant for an aerosolized virus, but they did all this. They told people to wear masks, even though there's overwhelming evidence before and after COVID that they made no significant difference to the transmission of such a virus. And that they did this homogeneously across the whole world, even in, you know, crowded slums in India, in Africa, etc. And WHO is very careful in the wording. They didn't actually say, you do this, but whenever someone didn't comply with what the media and so on were pushing, they said, this will cause terrible harm to this population. So essentially they did. And then they pushed a mass vaccination for the whole population, which again is unprecedented, in order to deal with this, even though they already knew by then, mid-2021, that most people in the world had already had immunity from the virus, from being infected, and that immunity was more effective than the vaccine. So it's a completely novel approach to what should have been a relatively mild outbreak.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, the collateral harms, as you mentioned, are, you know, a massive increase in poverty, in loss of education, if so, future poverty, in loss of GDP, which impacts health, and a concentration of wealth in the people who made the vaccines and the other gear that went along that was recommended by WHO.
Yeah, I mean, it has impacted across the world pretty much every aspect of society, hasn't it, David? I mean, the economy, the social fabric, the educational systems, people's mental health. I mean, the list is very, very long in terms of the negative impacts. Now, we've got a draft document now and the draft proposals for this pandemic accord treaty and the amendments to the IHR. Initially, I thought, brilliant, this is really good news, because a lot of the things I've been worried about, and many others over the past 18 months, seem to have either been removed or watered down. So initially, I was thinking that was good news. And I had James Roguski on the show on Monday, and he said, no, it's irrelevant. I'd love to hear your thoughts, and I'll tell you what he said in a minute, David, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on the draft treaty now. Is it good news that we've seen these things removed?
No, it's irrelevant. This was always nuances in wording. They were important in that they were there, but removing them is not going to change what is happening. This is not the WHO trying to take over the world. This is a large movement to move, or in the end, to move society to a much more sort of authoritarian model. They're using public health as an important part, an important tool of that. So the WHO is a tool in this. So the model is still there. These we will build through these documents, if they're passed, a huge bureaucracy which will surveil for viral variants. It will lock down countries and recommend lockdowns. And you don't need wording to do that. There are the World Bank is on board here, the IMF is on board, the media is owned by the same, eventually by the same owners as the pharmaceutical companies. What we saw during COVID will happen again, but over and over again, whenever we find a viral variant. And this is what this is setting up. It's also setting up a massive diversion of resources from health problems that actually significantly harm us to what is, in terms of outbreaks, a tiny fraction of what kills people and what harms people. So the collateral harms to this are going to be huge. But so they removed some wording saying countries will undertake to follow ahead of time whatever the Director General says. And they put back in a word non-binding. But it's still, the recommendations are there, and the enforcement essentially is the same, which is the World Bank, the IMF, the media and so on are behind this. It's going to be extremely difficult for countries to push back when the WHO says that this is what you should do.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, the thing that's really, the penny's really dropped with me is that, you know, countries around the world did this to their populations. They had vaccine mandates against international law and against a lot of domestic laws and you know, well-established medical rules. They did that regardless of those laws. And what this treaty is essentially doing is it's putting, as well as there being a stick, like you just explained then, for countries that don't toe the line, this is essentially a global trade agreement, and it provides incentives for all the countries to go along with this, because it shares out part of the capital flows. It rewards countries. And essentially what James argues is that's what this is all about. This is about countries all wanting their fair share of the spoils of future pandemics.
Yeah, I don't think countries are going to get much of the spoils. A few countries will. In the end, this is going to concentrate wealth in large corporations. That's why we have these public-private partnerships at Gavi, CEPI and so on, which are based around vaccines and vaccines for pandemics specifically, even though we only have, you know, one pandemic a century. So most of the wealth concentration is going to be exactly the same as we saw in COVID, which is shifting wealth from ordinary people to these companies. So the system that's being set up will largely be publicly funded. The WHO now gets about $3.5 billion a year. This is talking about $30 to $40 billion a year. in funding. And the WHO will do the surveillance. It's a large workforce, they'll pay whose job will be to do that, and countries will pay. Then they'll find these, the WHO will decide which manufacturers get the biological samples to make a vaccine. They have a 100-day vaccine program already running through CEPI. The WHO will decide which vaccines, they will manage the regulatory process, which won't have normal vaccine trials because they want it out in 100 days. So they won't have some good safety trials. And then they will set up the market by recommending lockdown, so that to get out of a lockdown, you need to be vaccinated. To travel, you need to be vaccinated. And there's no legal jurisdiction over any of this. And most of the funding in the end from this, the profits from, you know, this public supported venture will go to the pharmaceutical companies that are making the vaccine. That's very clear. They'll have freedom from liability under the terms within the agreement. So it's using huge amounts of taxpayer money around the world to fund this, I mean, this unlosable business venture from the point of view of the vaccine companies, who, you know, even the money to keep their production lines ready so that they can, at the drop of the hat, make a new vaccine is public money. So they have essentially risk-free profit. And we saw in the COVID time, we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars here. This is why this is happening. This is, you know, a windfall. It'll wreck society through abrogation of human rights, through impoverishment and so on. But you can see what is driving this, that this is a business deal that they just, you know, if you don't have morals, you just can't let go without being part of it.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's akin with the global arms trade. You know, the consequence of that, the result of that is death and suffering. I think the consequence of this obviously will be loss of freedoms around the world. Basically disregarding the health of the world, because instead of actually focusing on what we should be focusing on to improve the health of people around the world, all of the resources are going to be focused on this, as you've just said, David. David, we're going to take a short break for the headlines now, but when we come back, I'd like to get your view on, because obviously there's 192 members of the WHO. We've heard how there's been a bit of a... Is it 194? Okay. You throw me there. We've heard some, you know, there's been countries that have pushed back, like Japan, for example, I think has been pushing back. But I'd like to get your view on what the different countries are saying, because when you've got that many members, you would think that there would be some leadership in some countries that would be like, hey, this is really not a good idea, folks. You know, this is a global takeover, as we just explained. So I'd like to get your views on that after this short break right here on TNT.
TNT Radio News.
News break! Matt Boylant here with a look at your TNT headlines. Former US President Donald Trump has announced an historic plan to protect the integrity of the upcoming presidential election. Johnson & Johnson has offered to cough up $6.5 billion to settle over 50,000 lawsuits claiming its talcum powder products cause ovarian cancer. And one of Australia's largest banks has announced its customers will no longer be able to deposit or withdraw cash.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Right. So David, 194 members of the WHO, have any of them been raising concerns about the not just certain aspects of the treaty, but the treaty itself?
So some have. There's a very few countries. Some questions have been raised in New Zealand, Slovakia. The Croatian parliament has had some discussions on this and had some impact, I think, on the local, the recent election there. There is a decision of the Dutch Parliament recently to postpone this vote, which I think is a very important one. They asked the government to do that. I don't know if the government is bound to do so. But overall, there's been very little. Within the negotiations for both the treaty and the amendments to the international health regulations that are both ongoing, there's been a number of countries, particularly African countries, who've been pushing back on this because they see it as a reimposition of colonialism, etc. But by and large, a lot of the people in the negotiating teams, they see their careers in public health as being in this. That if you want to get a international public health career, it's either climate or pandemics at the moment. And so it's very hard for people to push back publicly, even within the public health area, because you're really damaging your future career prospects. I think within countries, you know, we've seen there's huge pressure from the media. If you go against WHO, you're pilloried. You go against corporatism and you're called a far right conspiracy theorist as a politician. So there are obviously, you know, we know of politicians in a number of countries who are very standing up, speaking very loudly, but they're being denigrated in all sorts of ridiculous ways by the media and by other politicians. So, and I think a lot of that is because in the end, this is about wealth for large corporations. Corporations sponsor the media and keep that alive, the mainstream media. They sponsor politicians and political parties. And it takes a brave politician, a brave party to actually go against this sort of pressure.
Yeah. So what do we do then, David? What can we do? Because people, you know, obviously informing people by talking about this now, but there's got to be things that people can do to try and push back.
Yeah, well, certainly push on politicians to, you know, and support politicians who are pushing back is the first thing, I think. There's movements out there that you can join that are sort of publicly going against this. There's an open letter to the WHO about stopping the, you know, postponing the treaty, etc. The votes are going on at the moment at the end of May. They're still negotiating both the amendments to the international health regulations and the treaty. The WHO's own rules, Article 55 of the international health regulations, says countries must have 4 months to consider a final document, to consider a decision before they have a vote. So the vote is illegal, and it is a ridiculous, from the Director General, there's a ridiculous statement recently that to get around this, that they had the very first drafts, you know, 17 months ago, and therefore that's more than 4 months, but they've been negotiating, completely changed the text over and over again since then. They're still doing that now. So there's no reason for the vote to go ahead. The idea that there's an increasing rate of outbreaks, increasing risk, is completely wrong. It's been shown to be wrong, both on the basis of the data that the WHO, World Bank, and G20 and so on are using. So there is no urgency. There's no legal basis to go ahead with this vote. There's a huge conflict of interest that we would never allow within a normal country. So, you know, at the very least, there needs to be pressure to postpone these votes. Outbreaks happen. We need to deal with them, but not in a way that harms the rest of health and the rest of society. So countries need to go back, negotiate sensibly, and come up with something which is actually a public health and societal benefit. And that's definitely not what we're going to get if we vote on these in May.
Yeah, and the other thing is, you touched on it then, conflicts of interest, really important this, because, you know, we've got, I mean, you know, I don't want to kind of ring the Bill Gates bell, but, you know, he's a good example because of his influence over the WHO via Gavi and via the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And of course, you know, one of the things the general public will have seen in the last 18 months is Bill Gates having private meetings with very, very senior UK politicians, not one or two, but lots of politicians, both from the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. So there are real worries. I think there are real worries about the WHO and who is actually pushing their buttons.
Oh, obviously. I mean, it's ridiculous that we have private funding going to an organisation that is supposed to be, you know, its mandate is to look after the health of populations and work in their interests. And it is clearly heavily influenced, I would say mostly influenced now, by private and corporate interests and by a couple of countries who have very strong investments in pharma. And so, yeah, it's not complicated. If a corporation or a private investor invests in an organization like this, it's to get something out of it. And that's not going to be for the good of the world's population. You know, we're human. People work for themselves by and large. And that's why we normally have checks and balances to stop this sort of thing happening. That doesn't exist in the WHO.
Exactly. I think the public would put a stop straight away if 80% of the British government was funded by corporations, yeah. NGOs, which essentially are the front house for corporate money. Because, if you follow where the money goes and the flows from NGOs, a lot of that is corporate money anyway, that's just being moved around the system in a very opaque way. David, thank you so much for coming on the Freeman Report. We've obviously got that vote at the end of the month in Geneva. I'd love to get you back on after that to discuss this further on news or whatever happens at the end of the month. But thank you very much, Dr. Yeah, David Bell. Thank you. Right, we're going to take a short break now and we're going to totally change the topic. We're going to be talking about the upcoming vote to choose the next leader of the UK Independence Party, aka UKIP. So don't go anywhere. I'll be talking with Bill Etheridge, who's a candidate in that race, in just a moment, right here on TNT.
While serving in Afghanistan, I was hit by sniper fire. The fighting was so intense, the medevac chopper was barely able to land. In the hospital, I was given a 5% chance to live. It's a good thing math wasn't my best subject. Today, I visit classrooms and share my story. I talk to kids about dealing with life's struggles. I tell them, with a little help and a lot of work, that you can overcome any challenge.
DAV helps veterans like Adam get the benefits they've earned. They help more than 1 million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
I know that some struggles are big and some are small, but they're all struggles, and you have to learn to get through them. With support from DAV, more veterans like me can live their best life. And as a new father, I have one more reason to keep on keeping on. My victory is being there for the next generation.
Adam Alexander, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
You ever heard of a polyp? Sounds like a rare species of toad. Actually, it's a lump that grows inside me, your bowel. Look, I'm pretty sure if you had a strange lump growing on your forehead, you might get it looked at, right? But when they're growing inside me, nothing, nada. And the polyps I get can lead to Australia's second deadliest cancer. So, until there's a way to make them grow on your face, it's up to you to get me looked at. Got it?
The conversation continues with James Freeman on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Right, so like I said, there's another vote coming up and the votes need to be in by Monday for this vote. It is to choose the next leader of the UK Independence Party, aka UKIP. And I'm delighted that one of the candidates, Bill Etheridge, he has been on the Freeman Report before, is with us now. Welcome back to the show, Bill.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me back.
Bill, remind voters, who is running in this race? Who's left? Who are the candidates?
Well, it's a straight two-horse race between me and a lady called Lois Perry. Lois is someone who's quite well known for TV and media appearances and does campaigning on local against the whole net zero agenda. And he's quite well known for that. So there's herself and there's the old war horse, me, who's been to do with UKIP for many a year, former MEP and first joined back in 2011.
Yeah, and I think that's important, isn't it? Because it's quite a big choice. You're very, very different candidates. I mean, obviously, you've got years of political experience, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, the choice actually is a fascinating one. For the membership, we've got myself, I was there when we first grew the party to become a major force. I was there in Brussels with all the big battles we had with the EU. And of course, I was there on the referendum. I've stood for Westminster Parliament several times and kind of know the nitty gritty of how politics works. Sort of, if you like, started on the shop floor and worked my way up. And then you've got a completely different thing, significantly younger, although not that much younger as she tries to make out, but significantly younger, certainly far more glamorous and far more fresh voice in Lois Perry, who is coming straight into this. Her first experience of politics is to come straight in, hit it with all her passion and go in as leader and be very vocal and exciting in her presentation. So it's two very different styles of candidate. And I think I'm intrigued, obviously, as to which way the members will go. Hope that they go for the voice of experience. You've still got a few miles left in the tank yet. But, you know, we shall see. They've got a good choice. And I'm you know, I think in Lois, it's a very decent and good opponent. And if she wins, obviously, I'll be disappointed. But I think she'll be a great leader. So either way, we're good.
Yeah. Really, it's really nice to hear, actually, that, you know, you're not attacking each other. You're both working towards the, obviously, the same in the same election. But the fact that, yeah, very, very positive there. Bill, you've obviously been holding lots of hustings. I'm sure that you must have spoken to hundreds, if not thousands, of members over the past few weeks and months. What are they saying to you? What are people, UKIP members, worried about at the moment?
Well, first and foremost, they're worried about getting the party back onto a footing where we can stand candidates all over the country, getting a network back together, getting a campaigning structure underway, which, you know, all the other things don't really matter if you haven't got a proper structure to campaign. But then in terms of policy issues, obviously, number one is always immigration, both legal and illegal. And the issues that were around that and the Rwanda policy and so on. And then there's a wide range of things that just aren't represented. Cost of living has been mentioned a few times, lack of true democracy in the UK. And the general, actually, they're a rather well-informed bunch, UKIP members. And they have concerns right across the board. And it's been, the hustings actually have been brilliant because you're on your toes all the time. You cannot guess what's going to come out of that. Once you've got past the obvious immigration issues, then, blimey, it could be anything. And it's been great fun.
Yeah, and UKIP, you know, when you look at their manifestos of previous elections, you know, the press, the legacy press, always wants to present the party as just, you know, always against immigration. That's what the party is essentially about. But actually, you know, those manifestos got some really, really detailed and quite forward-looking policies on a range of different issues. Not quite how the press present UKIP all of the time. Now, Bill, what do you make, if we talk about asylum for a second? You know, we've got the Rwanda bill. I'd love to get your opinion on what you think about that and whether you think it'll work. But also, you know, we're on the edge of a general election this year. If we believe the polls, Labour is going to form the next government. And we've heard this week that Labour are all of these people coming in illegally across the channel. The Labour Party are just going to grant them asylum. They're quite happy with that. What are your thoughts on the whole issue at the moment in the UK, the Rwanda bill and that?
Well, the Rwanda bill is a costly gimmick. The whole concept is utterly ludicrous. We've got people who are travelling across one of the smallest pieces of water separating two countries that you can imagine. We're going to get them, once we've found them, because we've let them sort of wander freely around, even though they're not in any way vetted or checked. Once we've found them, we're then going to lay on flights to take them off to Africa, with the legal costs involved and all the rest of the issues that are involved in it. It's an insane gimmick, which is just a pure waste of money. The boats need to be stopped before they get to the UK. And if by chance someone does get across, we've got to find ways of getting them sent back from whence they came, which are nothing to do with having to fly off to deepest Africa. It's ludicrous.
Do you not think, though, I mean, I agree that I don't think it's going to work, but more because of the way that it's being deployed by the UK government. At the moment, You know, they've, I think, identified 5,000, around 5,000 people that will potentially be sent to Rwanda. Of course, the actual numbers will be tiny because of the costs and the complications with the policy. So it's not much of an incentive as far as I can see in terms of the deployment. But Bill, I think if the UK government were to look, the people that are already here, put them aside for the second, right? We've got to stop new people coming across. I'm certain that if you went across to France and you went across to the places in Europe where people are making their way through to the camps in France, and you told them that from Sunday, the next so many boats that come across are going to be met by border police. You're going to be marched off to a detention centre and then processed for flying off to Rwanda. I think it could act as a deterrent because these people are paying thousands of euros to the smugglers, and you're not going to get on a boat and pay all of that money, are you, if you think that your boat is going to be one of the ones which is going to be stopped? So, I mean, that's my view. What do you think about that?
Well, first and foremost, it would never be that efficient. You know, it would be nice to think that our government or our state could organise something that efficient, but the reality is it simply wouldn't be. But I've been to these camps in Calais and spoken to the people there. And they're on their mobile phones in communication with people in the UK on the ground, discussing what life is like here, what freebies they get given, how they get looked after. Whatever we try and put out as some kind of deterrent, they will know the reality because they're talking to their friends, family, etc., who've already got here. I was struck by the number of people with mobile phones in those camps, actually. It was extraordinary. And they're all the latest ones, by the way. So it's an organised thing here, and we can't do a bluff, and we can't make a deterrent where it's not really going to be effective. And what's more, I'm a taxpayer, and I don't want millions and millions of taxpayers' pounds wasted on flying people halfway around the world when they've just come over from next door. I cannot conceive of a more ridiculous waste of money than this scheme, when all they've got to do is get tough and stop them coming over. When they do come over, ship them straight back to France. You know, this is a sign. If the French don't like it, tough.
Yeah, it was interesting, actually. I see the conversations about, Europe, the EU worries about migrants that have come to the UK crossing over to Ireland from Northern Ireland, because, of course, they could go to Northern Ireland. And there was even talk, wasn't there, about we're going to put guards at the border. There was a very, very quick climb down from that, because, of course, that would have been, a gift to the Brexiteers, because it would have been like, hang on, you accused us for wanting to put border infrastructure there, and now you're going to do it. Okay, let's talk about, because what you didn't talk about the Labour Party, because, like I said, we're on the edge of a general election. The Labour Party have come out this week and said that they will be happy to grant asylum to all of these people coming across. Do you think that's going to affect the election at all, given, I think, that immigration is one of the big ones, along with the economy this year?
I don't think it will affect the election for the simple reason that the vast majority of people who will be voting Labour are doing it with one purpose, and that is to remove this stale, corrupt, hopeless government. They're not voting Labour because they agree with the policies. I mean, that's a given. I mean, if you took each Labour policy that did a poll on it, I'm pretty convinced you'd find they're not all that popular. All people care about right now is getting rid of little Rishi Sunak and his bunch of corrupt oddballs in government. And there's going to be huge buyer's remorse after the election, because people think, oh, from a week or two ago, oh, thank goodness for that. We've got rid of that bunch of losers. And then Labour will start putting some of his policies into action, and people will be horrified. And that, incidentally, is exactly where I think UKIP will start coming into its own, because we'll be positioned as the party of the working people, and really standing up for patriotic working people, and not full of these oddball ideas. I mean, an amnesty for illegal immigrants, probably the least popular policy you could possibly dream of. And the only way you could ever get elected with that kind of policy is if you were fighting against useless Rishi Sunak and this government.
Yeah, I think you're right, Bill. I think the prospects for UKIP, if it plays its cards right, is very, very good, actually, because there will be, if the polls are right and the Conservatives do take a thumping, there's going to be a realignment on the right of politics, definitely a vacuum there. Because, many of us have said for years now, the Conservatives aren't conservative. We need a right-leaning party. Now, talking about elections, obviously today is the local elections, the Police and Crime Commissioner elections and the mayoral elections across England and Wales. How do you think UKIP will fare? Have they got many councillors standing across England?
Well, we haven't stood candidates in the mayoral elections because we believe that the position itself should be got rid of. So we're not standing in that. But we have a limited number of council candidates standing. I mean, we've got to be honest. And one of the things that I hope to do, should I be UKIP leader, is to be straight with people and tell them exactly where we're at, and exactly what we want to do. Because what we want to do relies on people coming forward and putting their head above the parapet and joining us to work with us. We don't have enough candidates out, and that's not for lack of effort from the party. And the candidates we have got out, I absolutely tip my cap to them, because they've gone for it with very little support. Where we're starting from is a low point in terms of membership and candidates. Where we intend to be is to be contesting all of these council seats, like I did back in 2014 and won a council seat. We can do it again, but we need the people to trust us, to come with us, to know that we're not going to be fighting each other and not going to be squabbling like happened in the past. We're going to be united with a common sense, straightforward, honest approach, reflecting the views of the vast majority of the people of this country. And once that message starts getting across, which will be really hard work, because aside from good people like yourselves, we don't always get as much media coverage as we would like, but we put the effort in, and that message will start to come across. And I hope people will see me, someone who has demonstrated what you can achieve with a UKIP rosette on, that you can make a change, you can get elected, but also somebody who's still very down to earth, very much one of the people, and won't be sort of talking down to them, but will be leading a team rather than sort of standing on high and taking all the plaudits and all the glory and expecting them to do the dirty work. I believe in, we're all in it together, we'll all get stuck in.
Yeah. And those elections today, what's your call? What do you think is going to happen? I mean, it's pretty much a certainty that the Conservatives are going to have an awful night. But is that news baked in? Are they just going to say, well, actually, it wasn't as worse as what we thought it was, so that's a success? And also, do you think Rishi Sunak will survive this? Of course, because there are a lot of rumours about the fact that if it does go bad tonight, tomorrow, when the results come out, he's a goner. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think the certainty is that Labour are going to make huge inroads. Where the things that Rishi Sunak may cling on to come into places like the West Midlands mayoral election, where Andy Street, who's the Conservative mayor, has distanced himself completely from the Conservative Party, but is actually, in the polls, it would appear, just ahead of Labour. Now, if the Tories can win the West Midlands mayoral election, that's a really significant win. It'll have nothing to do with Rishi Sunak, by the way, but he will use that as something to cling to. If they get the kind of drubbing that is likely, if the swing is another 1 or 2% more against them, it's going to be very hard for Sunak to hold on. And he'll have two options. He'll either have to call a general election, in which case it's too late for them to get rid of him, or he'll face up to the notorious Tory men in grey suits wielding the knife, stabbing him in the back until he has to go. There won't be another way forward for him. So I think this could all balance on swings of 1 or 2% here or there. If it's a bad defeat, he survives and says, look, let's try and drag this out until the economy improves. If it's a disastrous defeat, he's got to call a general election or he's got to go.
Yeah. Bill Etheridge, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming on the Freeman Report, Bill. Just remind the viewers, if they are UKIP members, when do they need to get their vote in by?
I would do it straight away. You'd need to post it off either today or tomorrow at the latest.
Fantastic. So if you are a UKIP member and you plan on voting, you haven't done yet, go and do it now, quickly. Right, Bill, thank you so much for coming back on, and please do come back on again in the future. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Right, okay, that's it for this hour of the Freeman Report, but I'll be back in just a second for the second hour. I've got a great show lined up, so don't go anywhere. Stay right where you are, right here on TNT.